And also from a recovery and work capacity standpoint, like, let's say that, you know, you can only deadlift 100 kilos and your best clean is 90 or 95. Like, that's going to feel like a lot of weight, relatively speaking. Whereas, like, if you can pull 150, 160 kilos and you're, you know, you're just trying out for 100 kilo cleans, relatively it feels lighter and you have the ability to recover faster from those cleans. It doesn't feel like a max effort every time that you're doing it.
Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Mike Bletzer here with Doug Larson, Andy Galpin, and our guest today is Steffi Cohen. And you're an incredible lifter. You've lifted a lot of weights. You also have a really cool story. And you came through soccer, Venezuela, and then you made it to the United States. And I saw you go come into the scene on Instagram. It was a year or two ago. It was when I really noticed first. I was like, holy shit, this chick is strong. Good job. Could you tell us what your numbers are? Like body weight and best numbers?
Yeah, so I compete in the 123-pound weight class in powerlifting and then 117-pound in Olympic weightlifting. In powerlifting, my best numbers are 370-pound squat, a 205-pound bench, and a 445-pound deadlift. So far.
Jeez. So you're rocking like a 3x body weight squat, and then that deadlift's like 3.5, something like that.
I'm going for a 4x body weight deadlift. I've been actually dabbling between the 123 and 114 class in powerlifting. My last meet, I did terribly on, so let's not talk about that.
Oh.
But I did compete in the 114 class, and I mean, had I hit the numbers that I could, would have been, I think, pretty close to a 4x, if not 4x deadlift.
Yeah.
A 4x body weight deadlift.
I mean, there's not many people in the world, male, female, any weight class, that have hit a 4x body weight deadlift. That's really impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In fact, do you have any idea how many people are out there that have done that?
No. Actually, I'm not sure.
You know?
I have no idea.
I've seen one person do that at the Arnold. He was a 181. He pulled like 800 pounds. Like, tall, lanky dude. But even when I was watching that, I was thinking, like, I don't really recall ever seeing a 4x times body weight deadlift before.
I can't imagine that many females either. If ever. Like, that might be the first huge number. Yeah.
Yeah. Are any of those records in any divisions or organizations?
Yeah. So I held the squat and total records, or world all time records, for about a month before they got broken again. Yeah. But I did it.
Bitch.
I did it.
Who was it?
I don't know.
You want to take a tire iron to your knee?
Yeah. Right.
Nancy Kerrigan style?
Yeah.
For you older cats out there?
Yeah. Right.
Half the audience is like, who is it? Nancy Kerrigan?
What? Tanya Harding? What?
Yeah. That was amazing.
What about your weightlifting numbers?
And my weightlifting numbers, I've hit in training an 87-kilo snatch. What's that? 95.
That's good is what that is.
Yeah, something. And
what?
105 clean and jerk.
Yeah, so 90 kilos is 198 kilos. Minus about 7 pounds. So yeah, 190, 191, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bad.
And you're studying physical therapy at
I
the
am.
Moment. Yeah.
I am.
How's that going?
It's rough. It's rough, but it's 100% worth it. And I just started my third year, so the first 2 years have been, you know, a journey. They say, I don't know if they say that for like every grad school program, but they say that in the first year they bored you to death. The second year, or no, they scared you to you to death.
There you go.
They
there
bore
you
to death, and then I don't know what the third one is, but
you'll
it's
find
been,
out.
I'll find out. I'll find out what the third.
I can't tell you. Actually, I've been sworn to secrecy. So.
No, it's been good. I mean, it's amazing for me as an athlete to be able to have access to all of the professors and the information that I get, and to be able to understand things at such a deep systemic level, you know. So it's been great in terms of training and just for general knowledge.
Yeah, it's rare to find somebody who is going after the education you're going after and also has this athletic background, because you have, you know, being in a strength sport and strength sports, It gives you a lot of extra information that a typical physical therapist isn't going to have, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And then you also come from soccer where it's a field sport. So that's a mm-hmm. completely different world there too.
Mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, like physical therapy school, they don't really teach you specifics of like training or sports or how to specifically treat sports injuries or how to make a person an athlete or how to make an athlete a better athlete. Like, we don't really cover that in school. PT school gives you the bare basics and a really solid, great foundation from which you can derive a lot more knowledge. And I think like all of that, I mean, you probably know, like all of that, those studies you do on your own, like you buy your own books, and it all stems out of curiosity. I think that's like the most important factor for driving knowledge and improvement. Like, how curious are you? Like, how many questions do you have that need an answer? And how many books do you read on your own time? And are you applying those concepts to yourself, to people around you? Like, there's been many questions that I've had that, you know, I've been wanting to about my own training, or maybe people that I'm coaching that I want answers to. And I try to talk about it with my classmates or even my professors. And honestly, I've been disappointed in some cases because they don't think about application. They understand it really, really well, but can they apply these concepts? And in some cases, if you're not practicing, then you can't, because you haven't even thought about that.
Yeah. Mm. What got you into powerlifting?
Hayden, actually. Before powerlifting, I was only doing Olympic weightlifting. I had a Cuban coach who had me training, you know, 2 times a day. I was squatting 9 times a week. I was back squatting every day, front squatting every other day. It was a very, like, Olympic weightlifting specific, like, no accessory exercises, just snatch, clean, and jerk, snatch, clean, and jerk. I did that for about 3 years, and then I met Hayden, and he's been into powerlifting for a while. So he said, oh, how about, like, do you want to just, like, max out your deadlift, see what you can hit? And I think in my first time maxing out my sumo deadlift, I hit a 300-pound deadlift, and he's like, you should do this. You're going to be good at this.
Yeah, I mean, Hayden's strong as fuck, too. Like, you're over there, like, squatting 600 pounds raw, right? At least? 640? Yeah, I mean, Hayden, you used to train with all of our good friend Travis Mass, and then that's kind of how you got into the strength sports as well? Not to turn this into an interview from across the room, but just to add context.
Anyways, we're not so concerned about you anymore. Let's talk about you.
Hayden's
a strong dude, done a lot of powerlifting, and so that was a good match coming in, very, very strong. You know, dating Hayden now, who also is very, very strong, good strength background. So
absolutely.
So you came in and you realized that, man, like, first try ever, I deadlift well over 300 pounds. Maybe I could be really good at this.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that when you're choosing a sport, I mean, you know, I've been competitive in sports since I was 8, starting with soccer and making a national team and stuff. But before soccer, it's not like I just did soccer and I was immediately good at it like I would in any other sport. I tried a bunch of sports. I tried gymnastics, basketball, karate, baseball, like when I was younger. And I kind of like discovered that I had a talent for this sport, that I have that potential to be good at it. So kind of like the same thing happened with powerlifting. I tried a bunch of things. I ran half marathons. I tried Olympic weightlifting, which, you know, I'm decent at too. But then I found powerlifting and I figured, you know, I have the right proportions. I'm suited for the sport. I think I have the potential to achieve great things.
How old were you when you first started lifting of any kind?
21.
21. You didn't lift any weights?
21. No, nothing.
Wow.
And even in soccer, we never lifted.
Right. And then how old were you when you – so you started at 21, and then when was your first competition?
That year, probably. I think I competed like a few months after I started.
And that was weightlifting?
Weightlifting.
Wow.
Okay, so you went through a couple of years of weightlifting where snatch, clean, and jerk, squat more or less every day. And then now that you are deep in the powerlifting world, how has your training changed and evolved over time in this new sport?
Yeah, so I love Olympic weightlifting, so I didn't want to give it up, which is why I started training hybrid. So I started – we found a way to program both into our training in a way that wouldn't mess either one of those up for us. So I started adding a lot more just deadlifting, bench, and squats at a higher intensity than I was before, because when I was doing Olympic weightlifting, it would be maybe 80-85%. You know, you treat your squats as an accessory lift. The snatch and the clean and jerk are your main lifts. So ever since I started doing powerlifting, I've been focusing a lot more on strength and getting those numbers on those three lifts up, and kind of I've let snatch and clean and jerk go to the backseat for a little bit, just especially because I'm not competing in them. Mm-hmm. But I still train them every once in a while.
So being really proficient at snatch and clean and jerk and having a lot of experience with those movements and the mobility to do those movements before coming to powerlifting, then focusing on like true raw strength in a variety of ways. Did you see your numbers in weightlifting go up once your raw strength numbers from powerlifting went up?
Yeah, I'm huge, amazingly. Like the first time that I stopped doing Olympic lift, I think I took like a 3 or 4 month break from snatching clean and jerk just because I personally was really burned out. I felt like just I could not do snatch clean and jerk anymore. So I focused all my energy on powerlifting. I did a few powerlifting meets, got really hooked into it. And then I came back after, I think, the weekend of Reebok Record Breakers last year in November. And I came back to the gym and I'm like, you know what? I feel like snatching clean and jerking. And I didn't think about it at all. I just kind of, you know how you tend to like overthink so much snatching clean and jerk. Oh, this is the right technique. Mm-hmm. Like, is this what I'm supposed to do? Whatever. So I just came into the gym and I kind of like trusted that I've gotten stronger and that I had the strength to PR that day. And I ended up hitting like 10 kilo PR snatch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And a 5 kilo PR clean and jerk that day. Like my snatch had been stuck at the same number forever. And I feel like I had this strength, but I couldn't commit to it. I don't know. And kind of having that strength surplus really gave me the confidence that I needed to hit that number that day, I think.
So how did that experience change your beliefs on strength and power and training?
Well, I think that strength is never a weakness. Hmm. You know, I think
that's a great quote.
Yeah.
No one ever complained about being too strong.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You can never be too strong. And I think that focusing on strength and getting your pull and your squat up will lead to having better confidence when you do snatching clean and jerk. And also from a recovery and work capacity standpoint, like let's say that, you know, you can only deadlift 100 kilos and your best clean is 90 or 95. Like that's going to feel like a lot of weight, relatively speaking. Whereas like if you can pull 150, 160 kilos and you're just trying out for 100 kilo cleans, relatively it feels lighter and you have the ability to recover faster from those cleans. It doesn't feel like a max effort every time that you're doing it.
I heard someone say one time, and I thought this made a lot of sense at the time, there's a lot of power lifters that, you know, if you squat 700, then you can probably clean, you know, 350 or whatever it is, like maybe half your squat. But just because you clean 350 does not even mean anything close to you that you can squat 700. So because you can do one, you can do the other. But because you can do the other doesn't necessarily mean you can do the one. It's not reciprocal like that.
Are you talking about clean and squat? Did you say deadlifting and squatting? Sorry.
In that example, I said squat, like a powerlifting squat, just lifting the ability to move 700 pounds. Mm-hmm. Like if you can move 700 pounds, then moving 350, even if it's not a movement you're proficient in, probably won't be that difficult. Mm-hmm. But if you can move 350 on a clean with perfect technique, that does not mean you can move 700 pounds no matter how you position yourself or what type of squat it is.
Of course.
Yeah, raw strength just goes a long way is the whole point.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in your case, you're competing in the 123s and the 114s. Is that what you said?
In powerlifting, yeah.
All right. So
between those two.
Okay, so you're trying to be quite small, and you got to be super lean to be that small. You got to be really strong, of course, to hit the numbers that you're hitting, 3x body weight squats, and you're shooting for 4x body weight deadlifts. Mm-hmm. How do you stay as strong as possible while hitting weight?
Mm-hmm. While making weight for competitions, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to train the heaviest possible without, you know, making it too hard for myself to cut when I have those meets coming up. But I think it's just a matter of like having your nutrition in check, like eating the right things in the right amount, in the right proportions, and nutrient-rich foods, getting your sleep in check, and of course, having a program that makes sense. I think that and even if you're cutting, you still have the potential to make strength gains, even though you're in a calorie deficit.
Yeah. So like, I'm going to ask a really, really hard question,
okay.
But just because I'm very curious. Could you just like give us a sample week of your training and then of your as much as you can about your food? So what's a normal week when you're trying to do your hybrid powerlifting / weightlifting and then the food?
Okay. Yeah, so hybrid is basically it's a progressive overload program, kind of like a daily undulated periodization. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that, you know, we start with high volume, low intensity squats at the beginning of the week. So we'll start doing maybe 70% for sets of six. On the first day, we squat 4 times a week.
Okay.
Then the next day, it'll go up to 75% for sets of five, then 80% for sets of four, then 85% for sets of three, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
That would be the month progression, right?
No, the week.
Within the week.
Yeah,
okay,
so within the week, like we hit.
There's your daily underlighting.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So within the week, we'll hit those rep schemes. In squat, a little bit similar in bench and deadlift, but not exactly like that. But kind of that's what we do. We modulate the volume and the intensity of the lifts during the week.
Right.
Kind of like in a positive slope.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second part of the question?
The food-wise. So then what would you be eating during the week? Some examples. You said have as long as you have your nutrition in check, you're fine. But what does nutrition in check mean?
So for me, I mean, you just you have to know where your maintenance level calories, what your maintenance level calories are, and take it from there. For me, I try to stay at maintenance. Like if I'm far away from a competition or even slightly higher, like even a little bit of a surplus so that I can recover faster. But it's just a matter of like knowing exactly how much energy does your body need to maintain that amount of mass.
Right. So that you can that way you can maximize your training, but without mm-hmm. getting too big at all.
Exactly.
Right? So without getting too far. And if you go too low in your calories, then the training goes down and the injuries go up, right?
Exactly. Exactly. It's all about energy balance at the end of the day. I mean, you don't, just because you're lifting weights and just because I'm trying to get as strong as possible, that doesn't mean that I necessarily have to add on mass.
Right.
Because at the end, it's energy balance, right? If I'm not in a calorie in a huge calorie surplus, at least, probably not going to put on a significant amount of weight. And especially for muscle, you know how girls think that just because they start lifting, then they're going to get like huge and all muscular and stuff. And that really is not the way it happens. It, the complete opposite is the truth. Like I've been trying to get swole for the last 2 years. And trust me, it's a lot harder than it actually is. Right. It's really hard to put on muscle.
Yeah.
So
I imagine with the hybrid approach, you're trying to get really strong at five things. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot more things than most people are trying to build strength around. Is there a decrease in injury in that case? I think a lot of people probably assume because you're doing more, you're putting more stress on the body, but you're having to program intelligently and spread it out differently. Does that variety help prevent injury over time, or do you find that to actually be a challenge?
Yeah, I think that having variety in your training can definitely decrease injury risk, especially because you're not, you know, you're not overusing or overdoing any one particular exercise. But more important than that is kind of like finding that or making sure that your program has like an optimal load. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's just basically kind of the stimulus or exposure that results in tissue strengthening, just enough to result in positive adaptations in your muscle, but not so much that it'll result in tissue breakdown. So it all comes down to how much can your muscle tolerate and how fast you can recover from those workouts. So I think we program in a way that's smart that won't put people at a high risk for injury. And that's at least what we've found.
You're just trying to get a little bit stronger every day.
Exactly.
Versus you're not trying to dig a really deep hole.
Exactly. Just not overdoing it. Just making sure that people can recover from those trainings fast enough to not put themselves at a high risk for injury.
Are there any times after competitions where you're not training like that, where you're just like, you know what, for a couple months, I'm just going to do some Metcon CrossFit-y things or just, you know, do prowler pushes and strongman stuff? Or is it like that every week, or is there a variety depending on when competitions are for you?
Yeah, for sure. So I like to treat my competition schedule in seasons. And I think that one of the things that is commonly overlooked is the fact that powerlifting and Olympic weightlifting are just like any other sport. You can't just like do it 365 days a week in a competition style mentality. Like I think it's important to go through phases where you're not training specifically for Olympic lifting or powerlifting, and you should just do kind of like general style training. Like you said, CrossFit is great, strongman or whatever, just something to get your heart rate up and work on your endurance and your work capacity, rather than just be so kind of focused on 3-5 movements, whatever it is that you're training for. So yeah, like I said, throughout the year, I usually pick one or two big competitions, and then based on that, I kind of start planning my training schedule around that. Have a phase where I'm it's general and I'm just focusing on endurance, feel good, working on muscular imbalances, working on holds that I've seen in other training sessions that I really see that I need a lot more work on, and then from there kind of like start building it up as the competition approaches.
I'd actually love to hear your thoughts on muscular imbalances. So have you found any imbalances, you know, over the last year, and how have you fixed those imbalances?
We all have muscular imbalances. I mean, there's not one person that's just like built perfectly. So I mean, for have I found any muscular imbalances personally?
Yeah, for you.
She's like, except for me.
Either except for me. I am built perfectly.
Yeah, like side-to-side asymmetries or just one lagging muscle group that if you fix that weaker muscle group, your entire lift would probably go up, things like that.
Yeah, for sure. I think that one of the biggest thing that exposes what your weaknesses are and what you need to work on is your preferential lifting style. So to give you an example, I am really good at sumo deadlifting, but I suck at conventional. Mm. So like, what does that mean? I mean, it could be anatomical, like just I'm built in a way that is just biomechanically advantageous for me to be in that sumo position. That's one reason. And the other reason could be, you know, muscle preferences. Like my quads are probably way stronger than my hamstrings and my glutes, for example. As opposed to someone that lives conventional that has a really strong glutes and hamstrings, to give you an example. So what does that say to me? That means that I should probably in my off season do less sumo and do more conventional to strengthen my glutes and my hamstrings.
Right. So during or getting close to competition, you're focusing on your strengths, but you don't address the weakness till you get out and away from the competition.
I do some conventional deadlifting too, as even when I'm in competition schedule, but I think that the off season's really a really good time to focus on that even more.
So if someone was going to, they thought about doing hybrid, they're like, great, I actually love powerlifting and weightlifting. I want to try both. What would be some of the mistakes that people would make just jumping into it and how should they not, or how should they avoid it?
And you mean if they jump into our hybrid performance method?
Yours,
or
they're
going to
make up their
general
own. Like they got so inspired by you to do both, they decided I'm going to make my own powerlifting / weightlifting program. In other words, why should they listen to you instead of just make up their own?
Let's take a break and then get into that.
Okay.
Awesome. We're back with Steffi. And we were on a break and you were wanting to dig into something. This happens a lot. We take a break and then it's like, oh, yeah. That's what
I think I was
going to
say.
Yeah, I wanted to briefly mention when Doug asked me
a question. Actually a little bit closer. Just like
okay. When Doug asked me a question about, like, how do you stay in a weight class while also trying to maximize strength? And a point that I really wanted to bring up is that there's two things that are the main drivers for strength increases. One is hypertrophy, and two are the neural adaptations that come with strength training, okay? So it's common to see, let's say, like, a huge bodybuilder with huge muscles that is not strong. Right? Like you can have hypertrophy without the neural adaptations, without the strength improvements. How your program is designed is pretty much what's going to determine if you get stronger or not. Even though it's well known that a muscle with a higher, bigger cross-sectional area, a bigger muscle has the potential to become a stronger muscle just because there's more muscle fibers there for motor units to innervate. But you can have increases in strength without the increase in size. And that is what we know as the neural adaptations. And basically what that is how well can your brain control the timing and coordination of your muscles at that point to perform a skilled movement. So like, is that connection coordinated, and how is the frequency of that firing from your brain is pretty much what's going to determine how strong that contraction is. So that's just a point that I wanted to bring up. What do you have to say?
Yeah, I was
going to
say muscle physiologist. You want to fill us in on neural adaptation?
Well, yeah. The other portion of it actually is the individual muscle fibers themselves can enhance their contractility without getting bigger.
There you go.
So the neural adaptation is funny. I'm being a muscle guy. I like to give all the credit to muscle, not the nerve. Fuck the nerve.
Yeah. What did it ever do for us?
Yeah. But your point is the same, where these are some of the things that allow you to produce more force without necessarily having to be bigger.
Exactly.
So the nerves are more efficient. We have an increased synchronization, so the right ones fire at the right times. The pennation angle, so the angle at which the muscle connects to the bone, can change, and this is going to have a trade-off between velocity and force. So if it moves in a certain direction, it'll contract faster.
And the pennation angle changes based on how big it is, you mean?
Based on training.
On training.
Yeah, as a result of chronic training.
Okay.
And how you train probably influences how it changes as well. Mm-hmm. And then the fibers, you're deep enough into the physiology, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is what releases the calcium that allows the muscle fibers to contract. That is thought to actually increase its calcium sensitivity. The contraction velocity, all that we've seen in our lab, change as a result of strength training. And I think one of the fun things that we've always wanted to do is to compare a powerlifting or weightlifting type of training compared to a more hypertrophic or bodybuilding thing. and we haven't really been able to do this, but I would almost guarantee my career that the strength-based training would actually allow the fibers to enhance their sensitivity of the calcium on the troponin. That will increase the contraction velocity. So all that to say, you're totally right, mm-hmm. is my point, that you can train and be very, very strong and powerful without actually having to make the muscle bigger, exactly. which is really important for weight class folks like yourself and any of the athletes that Doug and I work with. But I always say this is also a point for anyone who wants to get stronger but doesn't want to just look bigger. Mm-hmm. Like there are a lot of physiological mechanisms that allow you to get that strength goal or power goal or endurance goal without adding exactly. any more bulk to your frame if you don't want.
Exactly. I feel like we need to edit in like a list alongside you guys as you were just saying that. It's like words to Google. It's like sarcoplasmic reticulum, calcium, troponin, tropomyosin.
Crossbridge.
Go on. Google all those words.
Get on it, Hunter.
We don't have time to explain.
Do you do anything around here?
Yeah.
Gosh. What's the budget for this guy?
Too much.
So to change subject real quick. So the other day on your Instagram, you were showing like a half kneeling, good God, what was it called?
Windmill.
Half kneeling windmill, and you were making the point that you can get more range of motion, but you have to lock that range of motion in place by strengthening the end range. You want to dig in that topic a little bit?
Awesome.
Yeah, sure. On stretching and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So basically, what I said in that post is that stretching without taking your body through that range of motion. And utilizing that new range of motion is like typing a lengthy Word document and never clicking save. Like your muscles are not just, it's really, really hard to change the length and tension of your muscles and of your fascia just by stretching. It's really, really difficult. So we know that muscle length and tone is also modulated by your nervous system and by your brain and how you can control that one muscle is active and the other muscle is relaxed so that you can get into that stretch position, right? So essentially, I like to incorporate more active stretches and active movements that in which I put my body into the range of motion that I want to achieve and just kind of like consciously activate certain muscles and try to relax certain muscles so that I can lock in that range. And the second important point about stretching is that you need to be able to stabilize in that range of motion in order for you to be able to use it. So I think that a lot of people fixate so much on mobility and like increasing range of motion. You see like people with the bands in CrossFit gyms for like 40 minutes before their workouts mobilizing and increasing range of motion, yet they're still getting injured. Because really there's no research that says that more stretching leads to lower risks of injury at all. So can you increase the range of motion? Great, good for you. But can you stabilize in that range of motion? Because a loose joint, a lax ligament is not gonna do you any good if you don't have stability in that motion. So we always want to have that proximal stability if we want to keep injury risk low. And another important point about stretching is that I think it's important to see if you have like discrepancies from like one side of the body to the other. Then you do really want to spend some time stretching that. For example, if you have one hamstring that's tighter than the other, I think one that's pretty common for people is hip internal rotation. Mm. Like if you sit down like this and then you try the other side, you're going to see that you have one hip that's like super locked up. And that's something that you really want to address with joint mobilizations or even some degree of like static stretching. Did I answer the question?
What was my question?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
But there are some people that would argue.
Yes, you did.
More towards your point that the ability to increase muscle length is almost nil. In other words, like there's strong discussion that you really can't change the length of a muscle. So any improvement in range of motion is actually coming from connective tissue, and that also appears to be extremely unlikely mm-hmm. because it is such a non-plastic tissue. Mm-hmm. So most of it then is surmised to be coming from the neurological aspect of mm-hmm. it, which is why PNF stretching is so effective acutely, right? You can see changes of 10-20% within seconds, right? Mm-hmm. This is why reciprocal inhibition works so effective, right? This is why when you're stretching your hamstring, contract your quad, right? Because then you'll take advantage of Golgi tendon organs, things like that, and you can see much more effective. But to your, I think if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, is that's all well and good, but then at that point, you still needed to then make it contract.
Yeah, you have to
lock. But under some force.
Exactly. Right. You have to lock that range of motion in with some kind of active movement.
Yeah.
Like even if you're, you know, you're trying to increase your hip flexion, like you stretch it here, this is great. Like look at how much motion I have here, but can I lock it in? No, like it falls.
Ah, I right? see.
So, like, can you actively hold that position? And actually, I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Andrew Ospina.
Oh, yeah, sure.
He's a functional range condition guy. Sure. So I love what he's putting out. So I'm actually flying to Toronto next weekend to sit down at his seminar. It's a three-day-long thing. And I'm really, really excited to see all that he has to say about active stretching and that kind of stuff. I don't have that much information now, but...
I'm just going to go ahead and guess, since you're a young female, that you're super mobile and flexible.
That's debatable.
Okay.
I am more flexible than Hayden, that's for sure.
Oh,
he's not.
Yeah, come on. Look at him. Look at that posture. He's terrible. He's tech-necking right now.
Tech-neck.
No, so I'm just wondering, though, could you walk us through, because I'm sure you do some stretching, some mobilization. What's your warm-up or stretching look like? Are those separate things? How do you work that into your training?
So I usually I start my workouts with a dynamic warm-up. So basically kind of like lunges, forward lunges with like rotations and side-to-side lunges.
You're allowed to do that in powerlifting?
Yeah.
I thought all that was illegal.
Nope. Well, you don't do anything side-to-side.
No way.
No way.
No, you just, you know, yeah, most people just say you have to like stay
right,
here.
Right, right, right.
Otherwise you lose all your gains.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Totally. No. So yeah, I just incorporate some dynamic stretches at the beginning of my workout. And if I'm feeling tight, maybe at the end, just kind of like a little feel good, a little stretch at the end. Static.
Okay. But so you normally don't do any static stretching?
No, normally not. I've gotten into Pilates lately.
Right.
And I actually love it. You know, I think that a lot more.
No one likes it until they try it. And then
Have you done it?
Right.
No.
You've never done it?
I'm afraid.
You have never done it?
I'll get sucked in.
Oh.
Seriously,
that's what I'm afraid of.
It's fun. Yeah, kind of ish. It's
like
horrible.
It.
Yeah. Like your hip flexors and stuff. You're like, oh, I'm dying. And you're like a minute and a half in. It's awful.
Oh, I should probably do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why did we mention Pilates?
Just like your work, how you incorporate stretching and stuff into
it. Oh, yeah. But So Pilates is, I've been incorporating Pilates for maybe 2-3 times a week. Now that I'm in the off season of training, I have time to focus on the things that are important that I don't always focus on when I'm preparing for a meet. So, I mean, it's an amazing way to increase stability, especially like off your hip and off your trunk, while at the same time getting into positions that give you nice, safe stretches.
Right.
So what are your thoughts on just incorporating range of motion work into your workout? Like if you were doing chin-ups with just like a 10-second hold at the bottom of each rep, or doing pec flies with the intention of getting a deep stretch at the bottom of the movement, or you know pause squats where it's a 7-second hold at the bottom of the range of motion of a full-depth, high-bar, Olympic-style squat or like a front squat, things like that to increase range of motion while getting strong in those end range positions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that is great as long as while you're, let's say you're doing the 7-second pause at the bottom of a squat, as long as you're not relying on your ligaments to hold that position. You know, I see people kind of just like sitting down and then just like boom, they just kind of relax in that position. That's not necessarily good. You shouldn't be relying on ligament or even bone to hold a position. You should always kind of stay active in the position. But I think it's a good way to go about it as long as you're not just basically relaxing in that.
Well, I mean, you see that a lot. People will pause squat.
Yeah,
it's almost like they're like relaxing at the bottom.
Yeah.
And then it shows up when they're squatting with speed because you can – it's like they're skipping steps.
Right.
It's like a bounce out of the bottom all the time. And in weightlifting, like it's great to catch a bounce out of the bottom on a snatch or a clean, but it's not – it's not what you want to do every time. It's not what you want to practice. You want to be very strong at the bottom, which means you have a lot of tension throughout your entire body in that position.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Spot on.
Yeah. So if I have short hamstrings.
You have short hamstrings?
Yeah. They're like super short.
Okay. How do you know?
Because, I mean, they're right here.
She's calling bullshit.
It's like from here to here.
Oh, he just got called out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but say I have tight hamstrings. What do I do? Like if that's something that I think is a limiter. Is there what exercise or stretch would you have someone do?
You can do kettlebell, double kettlebell. What's this called? And I'm looking for like a Romanian deadlift, double kettlebell,
like,
Romanian deadlift.
Yeah. Like a straight single leg.
With a locked up.
Yeah.
With
like
locked
straight,
up.
Stiff like a deadlift.
Or just in like an RDL, like really stretching out those hamstrings and going to end range, maybe like in a deficit even, to kind of like gain some length.
Should I hold at the bottom or should just kind of be active?
Honestly, I don't know what the consensus is. Like, what does research say of, like, what is more optimal?
I can tell you research is not going to have a good opinion on
there
that.
There you go.
Yeah. But.
So I guess it would just be preference. I mean, can you hold it or maybe do both? Do some with a hold, do some without a hold. What do you feel that feels good that day? kind of thing.
Yeah, I want to circle back what Andy was asking before the break. Is somebody wants to get in, or is it Doug?
Me. It was me. Don't give him credit.
Who's getting the credit?
Oh, good question.
Of it first, and then I told Andy.
Oh, that's right.
Now I'm going to ask it. what? Someone wants to get in the, like, they're a weightlifter or a powerlifter, and they, I think a lot of people, especially if they come from CrossFit, have interest in being strong in all five lifts. Mm-hmm. What is the initial approach on that? Obviously, they could work with you, but you know, a lot of times people are just going to like start diving into it. What are the common mistakes that people are making when they're trying to get strong at so many things at once?
There's always the overdoing effect, the more is always better, no pain, no gain syndrome that most people have, that they think that, you know, oh, I just need to do more of this and more of that and more of that, when honestly that's not necessarily the case, and that's not the way that we program either. Like, we're very methodical in the way that we program and the way that the workouts are scheduled. And I think your question was more like, why should
it was
they,
the better question.
Why
yeah,
should,
yeah, right,
why
right.
should they? Why should they listen to us instead of just like doing it by themselves?
Right.
And I think
I see why you like that question better.
Yeah, right. It's a good question. I like it too. And I think it boils down to, you know, like you said, evidence or literature doesn't always have an answer for everything. And I don't think there's an answer of, is it a better training method to incorporate the five lifts in one if you're trying to get better at Olympic lifting and powerlifting? There really is not an answer. But what I can tell you from experience is that it does. And so I think part of our credibility is the fact that we've successfully been able to partake in both sports and compete at a high level in both sports without getting injured and while making progress for 2 years, which is how long we've been together and competing and running hybrid. So I just think experience combined with basic understandings on strength and conditioning and physical therapy and exercise physiology, I think it's a strong combination.
So with hybrid, are you literally doing all five lifts in a week?
Yeah.
Or how does that look?
Yeah, so with hybrid, you'll have the squat and deadlift frequency is pretty high, and then you'll be doing some kind of snatch, some kind of clean and jerk two or three times a week.
So squatting, what was it, 4 days a week? Benching 3 days a week or something, or four?
Actually, how many days a week do they bench in hybrid?
Okay,
two.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
Right, so 3 days a week you're pressing. Mm-hmm. You're messing it up. And then one day a week or so, snatching, 1 day a week, a clean.
Yeah, and different variations. We like to add in complexes so that, you know, so that forces people to stay at lighter loads and not necessarily max out on those lifts and really get the benefits from the higher intensity and volume of the squats and deadlifts and really get strong while at the same time they're practicing the skill and motor patterns of snatching and clean and jerking at the same time.
So earlier you said that more is not necessarily better, which is something that people say a lot on the show. It seems to be a recurring theme from many of our guests. So how would somebody know if they were doing too much?
They're not making progress in training. They're constantly injured. They're complaining about lack of motivation. Like, they're mentally checked out in training. I think those are the three main factors for just doing too much.
Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes if people aren't making progress, they don't go, oh, I'm doing too much. They go, I'm not doing enough.
Exactly.
I got to ramp it up again until they get injured. And then when they get injured or like they just totally lose motivation, then they're like, okay, now I think I'm doing too much. Then they try to pull it back.
You have no idea how many times we get emails like, hey, so I'm doing CrossFit in the morning, weightlifting in the afternoon, and then I'm doing powerlifting. Yeah, do you think I can add
you
the
get those emails
program?
Too?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we've gotten a lot of those too.
And we're like,
and I'm hypocaloric. Right.
That too.
I'm like, doing keto.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm like, no, actually, I think that you should do the complete opposite. How about you just do one?
Right.
For a little bit.
Yeah.
And just
So speaking of injuries, you were injured at some point over the course of the last year, and you've been battling back from that.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you at with that now?
Yeah. So I'm pretty much, I don't want to say 100%, but maybe, I don't know, 95-98%. I had a little back strain at the beginning of the year in January. I had just come back from taking a whole month off. I was traveling in Japan, took a month off, and not because I wanted to, but literally there were no gyms open. In December, which is, you know, New Year's season, everything closes like 10 days before, 10 days after. So we were pretty much forced to not train. which wasn't that great. But so I came back. I think that I started pushing it a little bit too fast as soon as I got back and just started having some back pain. And because I was preparing for a huge meet at the time, I had the USPA US Open in April. And, you know, there's money involved and there's recognition involved. And I kind of really wanted to compete. And even though I knew that it wasn't the best thing for me to push past the injury, I still did it. And I honestly, looking back at it, I don't know why. I think the best thing to do when you're injured is really listen to your body and give your tissues enough time to heal, because that's the only thing you have control over. You can't control how fast you're going to recover, right? So you just kind of have to take a step back and wait until you feel better.
What was your rehab process?
So basically, I stayed away from any squatting and deadlifting and started focusing a lot on single leg movements, braced movements, like stuff when I'm holding on to benches or the wall, so that I don't have to
stabilize
that much in my trunk. I added in the Pilates, which I think that really, really helped me, more so mentally. I think, like, I felt like I was doing something, you know, that was benefiting me, that was good for my health. And also, I mean, it's made the symptoms a lot better. I was seeing also a chiropractor at the time, pretty religiously, 2 to 3 times per week. So I got soft tissue work in and mobilizations and that kind of stuff. But I think the main point was that I didn't just stop training, didn't just stop going to the gym, because I think it's way harder to get back in if you...
You kept the habit.
Exactly. I kept showing up to the gym and doing whatever felt okay, whatever didn't exacerbate my symptoms at the time.
Yeah, and then you attacked your rehab from a bunch of different angles, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I think, another huge mistake that make is like, oh, I'm just going to the chiropractor, or I'm just doing A, B, and C. When really, when you have a specifically low back injuries, which are so nondescriptive and it's so hard to identify what the problem is, you probably should then therefore attack it from a bunch of different angles.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think a lot of people, I mean, when Doug and I were running the gym, it was extremely common to hear people, they like hurt their thumb. And then they're like, oh, I can't come train. You know,
they just
sit on the couch. And it's like, it's just moving and having your blood flow and it is going to help recovery. Like, just the super, you know, small basics, even if it's going for a walk. But a lot of times people suffer an injury and just completely shut down. And for someone, you know, and people will do that over like an ankle or something. But your back, which is involved in everything, you know, which you pretty much can't do anything without hurting it, and you were still really active, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I have a postdoc in my lab right now, Irene Tobias. She's a powerlifter and CrossFitter / triathloner.
Wow.
Yeah, so she's all over the place.
I do it all.
And so since she has been in my lab, we have actually gotten really sort of interested in the female athlete, particularly the female strength athlete. And again, by we, I mean... I forced to become, because she's driving it down my throat how we never study females and these type of athletes. So I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on training for these strength and power sports as a female versus a male. Should you train differently? Do you guys train differently? What are your thoughts on that?
So speaking from a completely anecdotal standpoint, from my own experience, Hayden and I follow the same exact program that we've written, and we train the exact same way, and it's yielded really, really good results for both.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, the main thing would be to understand what holes in training you have. So an example would be, I have a way weaker upper body than Hayden.
Right. Relatively.
Relatively.
But like, you're going to see that always in females.
In females, exactly. Right. So maybe I needed to increase my upper body and benching frequency up so that I can catch up. And then the other one is how much volume can you tolerate? Mm-hmm. So it's been proven that guys have a lower tolerance for volume than females.
Generally
speaking. So, you know, for me, I can withstand a lot more volume and I can add in more lower body exercises, more upper body exercises without getting injured and recovering quickly. Whereas Hayden sometimes needs to, or guys would need to take a step back in that volume and really make sure that they're recovered before the next training session.
Yeah, so the sounds like the core of your program is identical, but then you may be doing a few accessory things at the end to add more volume for you and add more upper body, and then he may be taking more recovery.
Exactly.
Right.
So I feel like a lot of people talk about, you know, this is backed up by science and you got to look at the research, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like in my experience, if you haven't gone through graduate school, then you haven't spent a lot of time actually looking at research. Most of the coaches I know that talk about science and research have never looked at a scientific paper ever before.
Right.
You guys are the exception to this. Like, you guys have looked at a lot of research. You guys both are into research in some respects. So I'm curious, for people that have never looked at any research before, like, how would you start actually reading real scientific research on training?
How would you start reading research?
Yeah, where would you start? How do you do it? Like, if someone's never done it before, like, what do they do?
I think you first need to understand the basics of research and understand statistics, I would say.
Right.
Because, like, all of these papers are open for interpretation. Like, you can read that paper and I can read that paper and I can get to a completely different conclusion if either of those of us doesn't understand how to read the paper and what those numbers actually mean. So I would say first understanding statistic and research and what a standard deviation is and what all those terms that come up in those papers mean, and not just kind of reading the abstract, jumping all the paper, and then just reading the conclusion and concluding the same thing as the author. So
yeah, I would agree. I would say that, actually, specifically to your question, Doug, if you're really the average everyday person and you really don't care, what I would say is don't waste your time. Like, just don't even start, because you're going to get tracked. You're going to say the wrong thing. If you are someone like us who's interested, then you can learn these things. There's a bunch of websites like ResearchGate where people can go to, and these are generally a bunch of free PDFs that authors are putting this stuff up on. So for people like you that are interested, you can go there. In addition, there's a lot of people who are putting out a ton of infographics on Instagram or websites and things where they're taking research and they're breaking it down into like a fairly user-friendly version.
Yeah, those summaries are killer.
Yeah, I mean, YLM Sports Science is great at that. Brett and Chris Beardley's thing, those are all fantastic.
You know who started an amazing compilation of articles? Greg Knuckles.
Yeah, Greg, yeah.
Eric Cressy, and who's the third one?
And Helms?
No,
it's
Mike.
Zordis, yeah, the Daily Undulating Period guy. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So they started, it's called MASS, Monthly Applications and Strength, and something like that. And they basically, you buy a subscription, and what they do is they take all of these complicated research and they put it in ways that you can understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, nice. They've got those. There's Alan Aragon's got the same thing he's had for like a decade or more, for forever. Those are all places to start for the general person, because you're very good. There's a great paper, or a couple of papers, I love to make this point. Two classic studies I use in my class, and what they did is they wanted to look at muscle recovery, and in their version, in this paper, they were referring to muscle glycogen. So this is the sugar you store in your muscle. So you burn that during a workout, right? And they want to look at whether or not I gave you protein, or protein and carbohydrate at the same calorie total, both cases, right? And see which one enhanced muscle recovery. Or did they? And in both two papers from two different labs,
how do you measure muscle recovery?
The muscle glycogen.
Okay.
So how quickly the muscle glycogen came back.
Okay.
So you biopsy them before, biopsy them afterwards. And both papers showed no difference in muscle glycogen recovery between the protein group and the protein and carbohydrate group. Okay, now that's the indisputable fact, right? That's what's proved. But the fun part then is, what's the title of the paper and what's the conclusion at the end? So now this is entirely true. But this is a great example of, you and I could both look at the same piece of data and have completely opposite conclusions and both be 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So for example, I read that and I went, oh, okay, that to me means I can add protein to my carbohydrate drink and it won't harm my recovery. The title of the paper was basically protein does nothing, because the protein didn't add to the recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, well, this, you could either use this to justify that protein's not doing anything, or you could use this to justify that you can add more protein and you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so that's what you mean when you say, like, don't read those conclusions, because the author is going to make that choice for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh, okay, great. Looks like I don't need my protein. That was all bullshit. It was all a lie. We proved you don't need protein post-exercise.
And also,
but they weren't looking at muscle growth or repair or inflammation or any of these other things we know protein does.
Yeah.
So be very, very careful with those things, and let that up to the scientist is basically what I would say.
And also, I think an important point is that just because there's an article, just because it's written in a journal, just because someone made a post about it, doesn't make it 100% the truth.
For sure. For sure.
Like,
very true.
I think that, well, like, what is evidence-based practice to you?
Yeah. So evidence-based practice, in my mind, is a combination of three things. It is the science is a portion of it. It is your own personal experience, your own knowledge of your own body and training, And then the third is the expert opinion. Mm-hmm. So actually, I just had my last Instagram post was about this and we got berated. People are like, oh, anecdote is not a part of the tree. You're like, you're a fucking idiot. Like, you're an idiot if you don't think that your own
That's
20...
That's an anecdote. We don't know he's an idiot.
Exactly, right? So the point of the post was, it was actually Brett's post, and I reaped it up, but the point of the post was a scientist, in my case, ignoring what Doug and Mike, as practitioners who have spent more time with actual individual athletes than I have, it would be as foolish for me to ignore their 20 years of experience mm-hmm. as it would be for them to ignore my 100 papers. Mm-hmm. So we're both making mistakes on that end. Evidence-based practice to me is a combination of both of those two mm-hmm. plus, okay, well, what I found works for my individual athlete and myself.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with that more.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny with wanting research to back everything up, because it's like I apply that to strength conditioning. I want research to back everything up, but then in the whole rest of my life, I don't apply it to anything. It's
right.
Like
totally.
It's like when I'm pulling out into traffic, like I know I shouldn't pull out in front of that car, and there's no scientific paper that tells me I shouldn't pull out in front of a car because I might get hit. But yeah. my anecdotal evidence says I pulled out in front of a car one time and I got hit, and I shouldn't fucking do that anymore.
Exactly.
And yeah. so you don't. It's really interesting how it only applies like in one field, but then across the board for every other category of your life, nobody brings it up.
No,
yeah.
I think
and it, now Mike did a great job because I think his daily undulating periodization study. One of the first ones was in powerlifters, I believe. But, I mean, you're talking like one or two training studies. So that, I guess, means you don't train because you don't know what's scientifically shown or not. So we're making inferences based on what we were trying to see, and we're just trying to help guide people in a direction and say this is what's probably going to work as a starting place. But you got to remember, like, your physiology is way different, so you may have to make a decision that we don't have any clue about.
Exactly.
Which I think your hybrid program is a good example of, because technically you don't have a single study to prove that thing works.
Exactly.
And you never will. So I guess it's a sham. You're a charlatan. Yeah. But no, of course. Like you're showing right now, you are proof in the pudding a little bit that says, like, this can work here, and this is how we've done it. And you've shown some pretty good success, I guess. Your numbers are pretty
decent. I suppose.
Yeah. For a girl.
So, what's next for you? What do you got coming up?
In terms of competing?
Yeah, just competing or training or anything in this world.
Where are you going for lunch? Like what? Oh, just kidding.
No,
tacos?
I don't eat anything.
Oh, right. Celery? Negative calories.
Breatharian. Just celery, carrots.
Water,
sometimes.
Mm-hmm. No. Good. Mental toughness. Good.
No, I have my eyes into a couple of competitions this year. The biggest one for me is going to be Reebok Record Breakers by Jesse Burdick. Mm-hmm. I was there, like I said, last year, and it was an awesome meet. It was really, really well run, really fun, too, with cash prizes and stuff. So that's one, like, the biggest one that I have coming up.
What do you
up.
Do with your money when you win it?
What do I do with it?
Yeah, I feel like money that you win is spent differently than money that, you know, you just get
for sure.
You earn.
I like go straight to Lululemon.
Lululemon?
Straight to Lululemon.
I use it as a bank. Hold all my money for me. Then they never give it back.
Yeah, weird.
There's actually a black market for Lululemon. You can. I've
really?
What? In Venezuela?
On the dark web?
In Venezuela? No, not in the dark web.
Oh. Actually,
this gets you off use Bitcoin fast. To buy all your Lululemon on the black market?
On Facebook, actually. I've resold tights that I bought for $60 for $100.
Really?
What? Yeah,
based on the patterns, people
We're missing
go,
out.
There's a whole world out there of obsessed girls with Lululemon.
Well, this is what, Gary Vaynerchuk was talking about this at one point. He said that the average person could, in America, make $80,000 a year simply by using eBay. You just go on eBay, and like you got the app now, and you can just go around scanning things.
Oh, and seeing what people
post
pay
it on
for.
eBay, and when someone buys it, you can just go pick up the item and ship it to them.
Yeah.
Ah.
It's nuts.
Wow.
So,
there's a business opportunity
not
for
shocking.
You, dear listener.
Yes. Yeah.
If you don't have a job, there you go. No one can stop you doing
was
that.
About, yeah,
is that like, covered in Barbell Business podcast? Is that
we're doing
there?
A whole episode, next episode.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, okay. And he was also talking about there's shocking how much shit is laying around your house.
Oh, yeah.
If
you
just put it on eBay, like you could probably make 10 G's real quick just from random stuff in your house. Like, people on eBay, I mean, people are just looking for anything.
How many cabinets of Lululemon do you have?
Honestly?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a little bit ashamed of that.
Good. That's why we want to hear it.
Honestly, my whole wardrobe is pretty much Lulu. But just because I don't know how to dress in any other thing, I swear I try.
It's safe. It's a safe place to go.
Exactly.
You buy Lulu, you look good.
You know, you just buy a tie, buy a shirt, and it just looks, everything matches together. You don't have to think about it. I've tried to shop in other stores, and I end up looking like a clown. You know, you see me outside, and you're like, what the hell are you wearing? Just nothing. Just, it doesn't go. Doesn't, I can't make it match.
Well, awesome. You're not going to unmatch any of the three of us.
Yep,
so
you're safe here. None of us have any fashion sense.
That's true.
Yeah.
Unless we put on Lulu, then we look like we know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No.
Where can people find more about what you got going on? What's your Instagram? You got a website?
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram at Steffi Cohen and at Hybrid Performance Method. And then the website's the same, www.hybridperformancemethod.com.
I have one little pseudo-final question before we cut out of here. Is there any advice or tips you would give to any females listening that like to strength train or are kind of getting started?
How to get into it?
Or whatever. Whatever message you'd like to send to the female strength and powerlifters and weightlifters out there.
I would say just do it. There's so many benefits to strength training for women, like ranging from, you know, just more muscle mass equates to more calories that you can consume because you have more active tissue.
You get to eat more.
That's really important. Also,
more chocolate
decreases your risk for osteoporosis, so it makes your bones stronger. And it's a great way to burn fat, burn calories, exercise without having to be just stuck on a treadmill for 45 minutes. It's a lot more fun. And then you have the whole community aspect of it. I think it's one of the things that draw me into it, that you can get into with strength training if you go to a CrossFit gym or a powerlifting gym.
Okay, second and follow-up question then. Mm-hmm. Is there anything for guys who are coaching females that you're like, hey, don't do this, or any advice for the CrossFit coaches that are coaching female athletes? The men coaches.
I would also say listen to your client, and especially if it's female and if she has like any type of concerns, listen to her. Don't just ignore what she's saying. Like if she's scared of building muscle, just put up with it. Kind of, I think that it's really important to educate them, the educational component, like explain to them why they can calm down about that particular thing or explain to them what are the benefits of strength training and what are they really going to achieve with it, and not just disregarding what they're thinking about it.
Right. What about during competition or like on the platform right before? Do you like to be addressed or treated a certain way that you think like is different than anybody else, or?
I think it's important, especially for guys who coach girls, to understand that emotionally we're a little bit more unstable than guys, and we really do need that like emotional support before a competition, especially because we tend to get a little bit crazy. Just be there for that girl and be strong for her in that time of emotional distress.
So what can they do to provide that support? Does you literally mean just like physically being there or anything in particular?
And emotionally, just like calm them down, encourage them and tell them that everything's going to be okay, that they're doing a good job, like positive reinforcement, all of that stuff. I mean, definitely it's not easy. And Hayden, who's my coach, that it can get really tough, especially sometimes if you get too down on yourself or you're extremely like worried about a competition. He gets frustrated as well, but it's really important to just kind of like keep that positive commentary going. Like, come on, you can do this. Like, you're going to do great. Don't worry about it. And I think it's part of coaching, not only for a girl, I think for a guy too. If you're a coach, you should be providing that for your athletes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
Great advice. Thanks, Steffi.